Hello, everybody. Mark Carlson here, SNEA Technical Council Chair. Welcome to the STC Podcast. Every week, the STC Podcast presents important technical topics to the developer community. Each episode is hand-selected by the SNEA Technical Council from the presentations at our annual Storage Developer Conference. The link to the slides is available in the show notes at snea.org/podcast. You are listening to STC Podcast Episode 43. Today we hear from Irfan Ahmad, CTO of Cloud Physics, as he presents a SNEA tutorial. Your cache is overdue a revolution. MRCs for cache performance and isolation, from the 2016 Storage Developer Conference.
Hi, everybody. My name is Irfan Ahmad. Thank you for taking the time to attend this SNEA tutorial today. I'm going to be talking about some interesting new developments in the world of caching. So caches are obviously main components in any kind of distributed system, even inside the distributed system of a single microprocessor today. The only way you can make distributed systems work is by doing caching and all different forms of it. It turns out that some work done about 40 years ago in the area of cache analysis has found resurgence in the last 5 years in both the academic and industry communities, industrial research, and there's some interesting lessons from that that we can draw, and SNEA was gracious enough to accept my proposal to have me talk to you guys today about some of those developments. Okay, so pass through this stuff. So the context for caching for me today, just to exemplify and to make things concrete, will be something like what I'm showing up here. So some sort of a database system perhaps, or key value store container, some applications running inside maybe a virtual machine or some other distributed platform. Okay. So that's a system context, you know, obviously running on servers with different layers of hardware, different tiers of hardware. And perhaps in some cases even an elastic cache out in the network. Okay, so different places these caches exist, so that's the first context for me. I'm calling that cloud scale data caching. But of course, that's not the only place. The same technique could be applied in a single system. An example of that might be an app running on your phone. Interesting things happening these days with, for example, recent iPhones shipping with NVMe solid state storage, right? So almost the first adopter in the industry for NVMe in a way was the iPhone. So interesting things happening in terms of trying to look at caching. So I'm going to set up a kind of an aggressive goal. I'm going to say, look, we're going to use the new research and the new results in the last few years, and we're going to try to provide self-service on sizing, tuning, and troubleshooting to end customers. Okay. And then actually improve the hardware efficiency of caching. Okay. So how much hardware you need of the fast medium, DRAM, flash, whatever it is, to be able to achieve your performance, right? We're going to try to improve that by 50%. Right? That's the sort of stuff that that's the level of performance improvement that you know gets attention. And then the next goal we're going to set up is that, well, using the latest research, we don't want to just improve performance, but we want to use that to create knobs. We want to give people guarantees. So if there's a client somewhere that specifies using an API or in a UI saying, I want 5 milliseconds of latency, right? We want to be able to use this new research to actually provide that. Okay? So some of this will start to become clear. But these are aggressive goals that I'm setting out, and I think the most recent work is proving proving that this might be possible. So that's first startup. Today's cache systems provide some sort of a dashboard like this. We're all used to it, right? Hit ratio. That's all they give you. And of course the current size, but usually this is pretty static. So hit ratio. Okay, so I'm getting hit ratio of 43%. Is that good or bad? I don't know. Maybe it's good, maybe bad. I don't know. Okay. Well, usually when somebody gives you a number, all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm motivated. I got a number now. I'm going to improve it. Well, can this be improved? Is this the best? best it possible, or if I tune it, or if I change something, can it be improved? Like, this dumb dashboard is not going to tell me. And there's nothing in the system today that is going to tell me. So we're ill-equipped to be able to answer the most basic question you can as soon as you put a metric up, right? So imagine CPU utilization. If somebody says my CPU utilization is 100%, and then you come in and you say, can it be improved? It's like, okay, you're 100%. We can't get any more out of that CPU because you know what to do with that number. Can it be optimized? Now, you have a number you can go and tweak. You can change your all kinds of parameters in the workload. Maybe you can improve it. But this is a number nobody knows what to do with. Okay, so let me get a little bit more interesting here. So let's say that is a number you put up. So we're talking about, for those guys who just joined, we're just talking about like a cache dashboard, okay, and the numbers it provides. And today, a cache, some sort of a performance monitoring dashboard only gives you a hit ratio. So let me ask a second question. What happens if I add cache? Okay, so I got 120, I want to go double that because I'm just, my performance is not good. Not my application level performance is not good. Well, will that improve the hit ratio? Or would it stay 43? Maybe it'll drop. I don't know. Do we know? We don't know, right? What if I remove? Because I want to give it to somebody else. I want to go to 64 gigabytes. Will that go to half? Or will it go to zero? Or will it stay the same? No clue, right? What if I add workloads? I'm going to keep everything else the same. I'm just going to add more VMs or add more apps or add more containers or add more databases. Don't know what's going to happen. It's a simple question. Is thrashing actually happening in this cache right now? No clue. Don't know. What? Well, I mean, forget this last question. Right? What if I change parameters? What if I change the read-ahead length? What if I change some other parameter? Will it improve this performance or decrease it? No clue. So this is the state of the art in almost every implementation of a cache today. So in terms of modeling it, you know, because that's when you start, you always think, okay, can I model this, right? And maybe I can get better if I know how to model this. So in terms of modeling, that would be like having all of this real estate in this graph and only being able to plot one point. That, what is that point? That point is equivalent to that 43% in the other chart. So that's the state of the art, okay? We don't know what happens if we change cache size in terms of the performance. Now, the performance I'm plotting is miss ratio here, which is kind of customary in literature. So lower is better. I'm just going to keep reminding you that whenever you see a plot like this, lower is better. Kind of like latency, huh? Lower is better. Okay, so that's the state of the art today. But what if we could draw out a curve? Okay, and the curve is varying the cache size. And as you vary the cache size, you just magically, the Oracle tells you, here's what the curve, here's the response of the system will be, of that workload will be to more or less cache. So in this particular example, this is a funny example. It's actually a real workload from a customer live production deployment. So let's say that you're operating at, say, 10 gigabytes of cache, right? So now we go back to the other questions we asked at the beginning. What if I double the cache size? Nothing happens. What if I double again? Nothing happens. What if I double again? So you would have gone through three doublings. Now, most people give up at that point in time if you were doing this in a real production environment because you're doubling, right? It's like, okay, three doublings, I give up. But right when you give up is when you're about to see performance improvements. Because remember, lower is better. Right? Less misses. Why? Because there's some working set, and I don't know this workload enough to know what exactly, but I can tell you the working set is about 80 gigabytes for the first working set, and the second working set goes out to be about 100 and maybe 10, and the third one at about 140, and then everything fits after that. So you see, so this is what we want. If we could have this curve for every workload in the world, we'd be able to answer almost all the questions that we asked before. Okay, so this is known as a miss ratio curve. So when I say MRC, please translate that to be a miss ratio curve. And sometimes you'll see people draw this the opposite way, which is a hit ratio. Higher is better, but we're not going to do that. So the miss ratio curve. So this is performance as a function of the cache size, and you get to see the working set needs. This is what we want because we can use this to now to inform allocation policies. Now, in previous tutorials that I've given, happy to send you references to those. Even at SNEA, I've talked about how this curve is computed. Okay? Today I'm not going to go through the details. Suffice it to say now there are multiple systems out there, including some open source implementations of how to do this with various level of efficiencies. For example, the company that I work for has one that we license out on how to compute this curve. So I'm not going to go through that. There's plenty of material out there. I will just say that the way that you compute that curve is by creating something called a reuse distance. So when you see a block A, you measure how many unique blocks were seen between the first reference of A to the next reference of A. Okay, so if there's 100 blocks that are unique in that time period between the first reference of A and the second reference of A, A being the block number, that's called the reuse distance. What you do is you measure the reuse distance for every block in the system, and you can draw this curve. Okay? So that's all I'll say about that. And it's not hard. There's nothing too complicated about it. To do at scale and efficiently is hard, but there are even multiple ways of doing that today. Okay? So this goes back, like I said, about 40 years. Before the invention of the first algorithm to try to do this, you needed to do a separate cache simulation per cache size. Right? That's very expensive. And in fact, in some of our experiments, to do the original algorithm for this, right, to run a day's worth of trace could take a day worth of computation. Right, and that's too much running on a fast processor. Just simply too much. And you know, couldn't you take hundreds of gigabytes just for one single workload? Now I'm going to pass through this very quickly, but there has been research sporadically in this area, a lot of times for CPUs and processors, but not a lot of improvement. So you went from order M, order NM in terms of space and time, out to a little bit of improvement here, and then you get into the last 5 years, and all of a sudden there's a tremendous amount of work that's gone on. So I provide these as references that if you guys want to take a look at or are happy to talk about it another time. But we're now at a time where we can do this in constant space. That means we can actually compute those Mitchell-Rocha curves starting from linear space to constant space, which is absolutely phenomenal. And then this order n is time, but note that the n is a number of blocks that were accessed during that time. So for a per block basis, first algorithm that does it in constant time. Right, because n, so n divides out here because n is a number of blocks. So per I/O, it's constant time. So the second time this was done, a couple of years after this original work, there's a different technique now, also available called AET, very interesting algorithm, only works for LRU. This technique works for LRU and ARC and other algorithms, and also. So now we're at a state where we as an industry, we just got to start doing this because there's two or three ways of computing these Mitchell-Rocha curves that are available to you in different form, right? So today I'm going to focus on more on what you do with these curves if you can get them. Because now, I mean, I think it's pretty well known in academia that you can get them pretty cheaply. So again, Mitchell-Rocha curves, lower is better. So these are just a bunch of different production SCSI workloads that I had access to. Okay, ran those traces, collected them 1 or 2 weeks, ran them through this analysis to see. Now, the reason why I'm showing this slide is look at the variety. So for example, this T08 trace goes out to be about 700 gigabytes, I think 1 or 2 weeks worth of a workload. And as you can see, majority of, I mean, if you had a 600 gigabyte cache, it still wouldn't fit this working set. And you add one more gig and all of a sudden everything fits, right? So now you have that type of a curve. You have the complete opposite curve where all the benefit is seen in the first 10 gigabytes and the rest you're just like getting a very little additional marginal return. So why would you give it more? So now I'm trying to motivate, first use case for this. If you had this for every workload in your storage array or your software-defined storage or whatever where there was a cache, you can take these curves and do some simple math and say, well, how much cash should I give to each person to drive global optimization? Okay? First trivial use case that comes out of this, right? And all we did is use traditional cache partitioning to be able to simulate that, right? Traditional cache partitioning. Give each workload some defined amount, but you vary that amount based on this curve. So you give that guy, let's say you have a terabyte of cache, you give that guy 600 megs, 600 gigs, and that guy only 10 gigs, right? And they'll both achieve their best. If you had a terabyte and you gave this guy 500 and that guy 500, guess what you're doing? This guy ain't gonna get any benefit, and he's wasting space, okay? And so this would be, at any point outside of this range, he's thrashing.
And each one of these blocks is certain part of the cache?
Single workload.
Single workload.
So what you're doing is you're saying, let's say this is a VM, right? Let's say that's a database VM and that's a virtual desktop or something like that. You don't know that. That storage array doesn't know that, but it knows this curve if it were to integrate it into its cache controller. And so without knowing the workload or anything about the workload from a subjective point of view, it would just empirically know that, look, I know how to improve this workload and I know how to improve that workload. Okay. Now there's lots of varieties, right? There's some that, for example, there's always a few in these plots that improve. For every gigabyte of cache you give it, it continues to improve. Every gigabyte of cache, it continues to improve, right? So now you can trade those off. And the trade-off is very easy. Like, that's easy, right? You just kind of say, I have one more gigabyte of cache to give. Who do I give it to? That's a naive algorithm. You can get better than that with simulated annealing, trivial stuff. An undergrad could write that code to do the comparison, right? First thing you need is the MRCs, yes.
I don't know if you're going to talk about it, but time variation of the key sets. So for example, it may look like one piece morning and something else in the afternoon.
We find that if you are operating about a day, they're very stable. If different parts of the day change.
They're assuming like long term.
So I'm not making that assumption. I'm saying you could, for this workload, you could have caught MRC every hour. They're so cheap that you could have captured it at every hour and varied your caching every hour. I'll show you some results where we actually did that work. And we showed that about hour is kind of like a good sweet spot where you can get a tremendous performance improvement or hardware efficiency improvement by buying less DRAM or flash to get the same performance benefit. But it's a very important code. Time varying is actually, that is a one area I would say is still being researched. I'm working with a couple of universities on really narrowing down on the theory about how time varying behavior can be modeled. That's probably the only area here that's open, and I'll give you some results about that as well. So lots of different MRCs, and it just motivates us to think, well, interesting, if I could have this for all of the workloads running on my system, I have cool stuff I can do. So now let's take a look. What are some cool stuff we can do? Okay, so I should have said at the beginning that to really get the most out of this talk, you've got to put in a little bit of kind of mental math effort here. But the first mental math effort is, remember you were seeing missed ratio curves before, lower is better. And now what I just did is I pulled a trick on you and called this an average latency curve. Okay, so I did some arithmetic to do this. Let me tell you what the arithmetic is. Trivial. A little complicated, but it's trivial. So I start with the missed ratio curve. What does that mean? A miss means that a certain percentage of IOs went to the back end because they didn't hit in the cache, right? So let's just say that the miss ratio is 50%. That means 50% hits, 50% misses. And let's say that the latency of a hit is 100 microseconds. And latency of a miss is 1 millisecond, right? If 50% of your IOs are hitting and 50% of your IOs are missing, you just average the two numbers, you have the average latency. Make sense? Because half of them are hitting, half of them are missing. Yes? So that's all I did here. Because for every cache size, I know what percentage will hit or miss, and I know when they miss, I know what the latency is. I do the trivial miss ratio times miss cost plus hit ratio times hit cost, and I get this number. And then I get a number for every one of the spots that I have on this curve, and I draw it out. So for the very first time, at least to my knowledge, in real deployable systems, you can get a prediction of what the latency of the VM would be, or the app, or the database would be, okay, as you vary the cache size. This is how I spent my entire career looking for this. Okay, we just figured this out 2-3 years ago. But my entire career, almost in 10 plus years of storage, has been in figuring out how to give people the guaranteed latency. Like, hadn't been able to figure out how to do that, and this is the first time we figured it out. Okay. So, first thing you do is you take your miss ratio curve and you convert it into an average latency curve, varied over cache size, and you get something that shape-wise looks very similar to the miss ratio curve. Okay. And then what you do is you say, dear client, what is it that your target is? And then you kind of just read that target down and across and say, oh, 16 gigabytes. Now I'm going to probably give them 18 or 20 just to kind of, if there's any variations of the curve shifting during the course of the day or the week, we'll give them a little more. But fairly simple computation, arithmetic really, once you have the original curve. And now we can solve something, again, very, very challenging, never been solved before. So I'll take a pause here, make sure everybody's kind of absorbing this. Yes.
So I got a question, because this looks nice, but what about situation when you've got like asynchronous IOs, and for example, one IO is hit, another IO is miss, and
we still need to wait for the completion of both of them. Do you somehow include that in your computation?
No, because I'm just operating at the average. I'm saying, like, basically, think of it this way. Let's say you had all, like a disk subsystem spinning Rust, okay? And then you replaced the same application, nothing changes, and you replace it with a faster thing. But I'm not going to tell you what the faster thing is. It's just average latency, let's say half or a quarter of what it used to be. The performance of the application will improve because on average, things are taking a quarter as much as long as before. So in as much as the bottleneck is the storage, the performance will improve. Yes, some IOs will be very quick, some of them will not be. Even in a single storage, single hard drive, if you run, let's say, something like Iometer, okay, there are some IOs that even for a single drive will come back in 100 microseconds. Single drive, like a 7,500, whatever, it was a 5,400 RPM drive. Because even the hard drive has a little buffer, and occasionally you get hit in that little tiny 1 meg buffer. And if you plot every single latency, like let's say you have a million IOs that you do, and you plot every single one of them, I encourage you to do that. It's like very enlightening to see what the variance. Once you see every single IO on a plot, you realize a single drive can also do very fast, and it could also be 1 second latency. All of that in a minute, and you don't even realize it because you only see the average. Same thing is going to happen here. It's just average will drop as you increase the cache size. Yes?
So the relationship between a cache hit and a miss is a constant, right? As you
go, yeah, one minus miss is
so,
hit.
So isn't the shape of the curve going to be exactly the same?
It is for average.
By a constant.
It is for an average. But some people don't want to provision for average. Let's say you got a client who comes up and says, look, average is nothing. I want 95th percentile. Mm-hmm. So then what you do is you measure the backend's latency for the misses, mm-hmm. but you don't measure the average. In addition to the average, you measure the 95th percentile latency of the backend. Then you plug this number in. What will happen is this curve will just expand.
Right.
It'll keep the same like need ratio,
right.
but it will
stretch
out. And then all of a sudden, to get the 95th percentile, you're not paying 16. You're paying like 100 gigabytes. Okay, but the fact that you could even do that
right.
is amazing. When's the last time we could tell somebody,
right.
if you want 95th percentile,
yeah.
I can give it to you, just pay me this much, right? Now we can do that, right? So now again, this is an amazing use case. Like imagine a network elastic cache in like a cloud service provider. If you can have this curve, you can predictively allocate DRAM, right, in a Redis somewhere. Forget like SCSI disk, just think Redis. If you know this curve, for your database, you can allocate a Redis or Memcache D of the right size, because you know we don't need SCSI for MRCs. But MRCs are just about references. They don't care if it's a SCSI or a memory Memcache D underneath. Okay. So it's the first thing we did. Extremely powerful, within reach. Okay. Within reach of anybody in the industry. Anyone who wants to have this feature today, you can do it as long as you compute the administrator curves. And there are three different ways of doing those today. Okay, one out of university and two of them commercial systems that are supported and you can license. Okay. So now, we're going to switch topics a little bit. Now we're going to go into tiering, because a lot of systems do some type of tiering. Even if you're all flash, there's a little bit of tiering going on because you've got some really fast flash that can handle writes better, let's say, and then you've got the slower flash for capacity, and that's where dedup is happening, for example, right? Now, this time I'm back to a miss ratio curve, right? So this is not latency. It's miss ratio. Slower is better. Now what we're saying is, well, we got tiers, right? We got local, and we got kind of remote, and we got really far remote. Maybe the furthest remote is out in the cloud somewhere. But if we develop our cache system appropriately, now we know exactly how much to size every tier for every workload to be able to achieve the performance requirements of that workload. Okay, the way to do that is every tier has a different miss latency or miss penalty. Yeah? So what you do is you iteratively figure out how much to give to each tier, and then the latency curve that you derive will be a piecewise curve, because during the middle of this curve, you're changing the miss penalty. So the miss penalty here is very low, here's a little higher, and here might be very high. So now piecewise that curve, and when you convert it into latency, will shift, and then now you can figure out how to draw this curve iteratively, right? So not without providing a lot of detail, I think the higher level point is you can do tiering, and now predictively you can figure out how much to give to each tier, either for overall efficiency for all workloads, driving overall throughput, or individual SLAs and SLOs. Yes?
Basically, the calculation on that, that's mean you already have a cache tier. Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I misunderstand.
No, you don't need a cache, you just need it. Yeah.
No, you're saying that, okay, I got X misses and Y hits, okay?
Yes.
And based on that, you're drawing your chart.
No, I'm not. See, this chart can be drawn without actually having a cache, because all you do, and this was the part of the previous year's tutorial, so I didn't spend a lot of time on it, but what you do is you say, an I/O is coming in. At some point in time, before any cache, you just call a little function that says, hey, please add to your miss ratio curve analysis data structures the fact that this I/O was accessed. Okay, so 1 meg buffer of various types of data structures, and that's all you need, 1 meg, okay? And then the fact that this I/O was handled or requested, or this row in a table or a Redis key was accessed, is enough for these data structure and this misratio curve algorithm, the history of which goes back 40 years, but it was not practical. Very recently it's been made practical in the last 5 years. So now that you tell that algorithm, hey, somebody requested this block or this ID or this opaque key, okay, it comes back in less than 60 nanoseconds and says, yeah, don't worry, keep going, I got it. Okay. That's enough. You can draw this curve in a system where there is no cache at all, and you still get the full curve. The point is, if you were to, this dot is an example of something where it's a cache stat. Now, you cannot, in a production system, vary the actual cache size to get the full curve. You can't do it. I mean, it's just nobody will let you, right? I mean, who's going to do that? Who's going to say half my cache and just see what happens? I mean, people, you get fired. So instead, what you do is you just install something in a system, and like I said, it's easily implementable, where without actually even having a cache or having the cache operate here, you get the full curve, and then you decide to reduce or increase because you can predictably know what the performance implications are going to be. Yes?
So you're binning it. You're putting it in a bin and then statistically sampling it across the space.
It's kind of like that.
Way to say
the technique,
the concept?
There are three different techniques. Okay. They all do different types of sampling. One of them does a velocity sampling. One of them does a spatial sampling. The other one does a reuse distance sampling. All different techniques. I don't want to go into them right now, just because there actually is math involved there.
Yeah.
But I will say that once you read the papers, you're like, huh, why didn't I think of that? Okay, this like that. Okay. Okay. But it is a sort of sampling. But the point is very accurate. And if I was to just to emphasize, there's actually two curves on each of these multiple plots. You cannot see two curves. The reason why you cannot see two curves, one is the actual MRC computed the 1970 way, takes hours and days to run, and the other one is seconds of CPU time for these very, very long traces. The reason why you cannot see two curves is that's how accurate the systems are. They're sitting on right on top of each other. So the sampled approximations are very accurate. Okay, so now we'll talk about two use cases. Let's move on. The third one, I think, is actually pretty important, and most people kind of don't think of it at first, is the self-service monitoring. Like, imagine putting this in your storage array, and for your customers to be able to actually see what's going on, like, you know, they'll buy more cache once they realize how much cache pressure they actually have. So, you know, just imagine, this is a mock-up that I did, and I'm not a UI designer, so it probably doesn't look that good, but the idea is, again, cache size, hit ratio. Okay, so this is the only plot that I'm doing with hit ratio, because I've tried saying miss ratio to customers, and it's like, oh, they don't think in terms of misses, you know. They're not, well, most of them are not engineers. So they think higher is better. So if it's up and to the right, it's better. If it's up and, you know, down then to the right, it's bad. So, like, you know, just to show customers, I've drawn this as a hit ratio. So if you ever put this in a real UI in your storage array or in your software-defined storage or in your whatever memory-based storage, please do it this way. I've learned the hard way. Okay, so now, but imagine giving this to all of your clients. Like, imagine having this and your cloud service provider. When you log into your dashboard for a cloud service provider, he gives you this curve. That'd be pretty awesome, because now you can actually size. So that's the idea here. Let's not forget the simple stuff, right? Simple and easy. Just measure and plot. Don't even do anything with it, right? Very valuable. Okay, so This one, again, we're going to have to go put our thinking hats on. This is the tutorial part where I got to teach you something. So something very interesting is happened recently. So remember I showed you a bunch of curves that had these flat regions, and I said, that's when thrashing is going on. Remember that? So the reason why it's thrashing, obviously, is you're adding more cache, and the latency is not improving. But interestingly, what's happening underneath is that the workload doesn't reuse the blocks that it asks for. It asks for A, and then it doesn't ask for A for a really, really, really long time. By the time it asks for A is no longer in the cache. It's been evicted from the cache. So that's why you get this flat region. Okay. And then when you don't get the flat region is when those blocks that were asked for back here are starting to be used. So that's why it's a reuse distance, right? Okay. So now the workloads that have flatness are the worst workloads in the world for a cache, right? It's just awful because no matter what the cache does, it just cannot fix those workloads. Because so it's not the cache's fault. It's not the algorithm's fault. The workload is not cooperating. Okay. The interesting thing is, recently we figured out, some work out of MIT has figured out, that if you can draw this curve a priori for a workload, okay, you can tweak your cache algorithm online on the fly to actually draw the what's called a convex hull against this Mr. Escher curve, right? So now this is thrash remediation like we've never seen it before, because now you take the worst workloads and you make them your slave. Because, okay, give me your worst one, I can fix it. Because the worst ones, always remember, have this flat region. And the convex hull means that you take the lowest non-convex parts and you connect them, and that's a convex hull. So now there's an algorithm, but it requires having the Mr. Escher curve. Again, this is something that everybody, all of us can do in our production systems fairly easily if we just add a Mr. Escher curve. Okay? A Mr. Escher curve computation capability. If you had this, this becomes within reach. Now, I'm trying to debate whether I tell you how this is done. I'll do it. It's a tutorial. We'll do it. Okay. So here's how it's done. Thinking caps on. Okay. So imagine that I have this Mr. Escher curve. Okay. And what I do is I say, okay, randomly I'm going to take half the blocks. Randomly, it has to be random, okay? And I'm going to put them into partition 1. I'm going to call this workload partition number 1 because it's just random. Take half the LBAs and I assign them to workload partition 1 and half of them to workload partition 2. Randomly, half and half, okay? Then I come in and I say I have my cache and I'm going to allocate half the cache to workload partition 1 and half the cache to workload partition 2. Easy so far, right? Half, half. Will there be a performance change? No, because I randomly picked the blocks and both workload partition 1 and workload partition 2 will have the same Mr. Escher curve because I picked them randomly, yes? Okay. But now I do this observation and I say, okay, suppose that I'm currently operating at a 10 gig cache. So now what I'm going to do is instead of making workload partition 1 and workload partition 2 equal size, I'm going to make workload partition 1 be 10% of the logical block addresses and workload partition 2 to be 90%. Now, I did something very unfair because workload partition 1 is getting half of the cache, but it's only 10% of the blocks. And workload partition 2 is getting half of the cache, but it's 90% of the blocks. Everybody with me so far? So what did I just do? Workload partition 1, okay, moved this way. No, actually, workload partition 1 was the smaller one, right? Okay, so workload partition 1 moved this way. Okay? 10% of the blocks, 50% of the cache. So it's going to move this way. Now, workload partition 2 moves this way. But what just happened is that workload partition 2 moving this way, it experienced no loss of performance because it was in a flat region to start with. Workload partition 1, though, got over this hump. Okay, now but to truly get over the hump, I also then go and start half and half in the cache size. I make the workload partition's cache occupancy not be 50%, I make that 90%. Okay, so now, again, workload partition 1 here goes all the way across. and ends up getting a huge performance win, whereas workload partition 2 never climbs up there. So if I can do the algorithm right, just using their basic intuition, and it's pretty easy to do once you sit down and try to do it, what happens is that my average performance between those two partitions ends up somewhere along this diagonal. So this is like, I mean, you know, remember the 90s and 2000s and the first half of the 2010s, probably more than 100 papers have been published on better cache algorithms. Okay? This thing beats all of them with the most naive cache algorithm because you're just cheating. You're just cheating. You're like, huh. Now, of course, it requires cache partitioning support. Not every storage array has that, so you got to go and implement it. It requires MRC computation. No one has that in a production system outside of, you know, some system that I'm working on with some vendors. So, but this stuff is not hard. You know? It requires a little bit of testing, but it's not that hard. So again, this is fundamentally game-changing. Use case for misrature curves. Now, basic stuff like I mentioned, you know, this is a trivial example of two workloads, single cache, but I'm partitioning the cache, and I say, well, this workload, look, it benefits immediately from a cache, but then it doesn't benefit from extra cache all that much, and that's why it has this shape. Well, this other one always keeps benefiting. So I'm going to give partition 0 to client 0, but a very small partition, just enough to fit his workload, and then partition 1 is bigger because he's going to keep benefiting. Simple idea, right? So then we actually tested it, and we got an average of a 40% larger cache efficiency or hardware efficiency. What that means is that for the same performance improvement, right, the performance improvement you got from this algorithm of partitioning was equivalent to buying 40% extra hardware on average. And the best performance out of these workloads was 146. So these are mixed workloads, so the kind of workloads that a storage array would see. They're not trivial single VM workloads. They're like anywhere from 8 to 20 different workloads mixed in. Okay. And here's the distribution of that hardware efficiency improvement. As you can see, most of the workloads in our test of 27, I think it was, different workloads had 0 to 10%. But the majority, the weight is 20 to 50%, and there are some that benefit more. Right? So again, what did we do? Look at it. What did we do? We just computed MRCs for each workload, partitioned the cache, and allocated dynamically. This was done once every hour for those workloads. 40% improvement. Like, how often do you get that? It's very hard to get that. And I didn't even add the thrash remediation in that test. We kind of came across that later. So cumulatively, once you combine those two, I think it'll be even higher. Definitely get over my goal of 50% that I presented at the beginning of the presentation. One more thing on this. So I keep saying, look, order one for space, and then order one per I.O., so constant time per I.O. for CPU for these algorithms to compute the misrature curve, right? Well, that got us thinking, oh, it's so cheap. And on average, every one of those function calls to update the data structure is 60 nanoseconds on a pretty slow processor. I've measured it like 39 on a faster processor. But those are even desktop class, but I've not even measured it on a server class yet. So it might be in the 35 nanosecond range per I.O. overhead. So that got us thinking, well, maybe we should do more than one of these. So I'm like, whoa, interesting. Okay, so hold on. So what you see here is multiple misrature curves for single workload. Okay? So why are there multiple misrature curves for single workload? Well, in this particular case, we assumed a different cache block size. And said, suppose this workload was running at 4K or 8K or 16K or 32K or 1 meg. I'm going to compute simultaneously. It's so cheap. You can simultaneously compute multiple misrature curves for the same workload. And then you just, again, undergrad could write this and come in and say, hey, for this workload, is a 4K block size better or a 16K cache block size better? Okay. We have seen 50% performance improvement if you perfectly pick the right cache block size for the given cache that you want to give that workload. In some cases, we've seen 100%, but 50% is like very common to see. And you can see that, right? You know, different cache block sizes, you can imagine, right? If your cache block size is too big, you're pulling in too much data. It's going to slow you down. If it's too small, if it's not quite right, then you're not getting other benefits in terms of metadata. And then, so this is different workload. So you see, it's per workload, right? So depending upon the workload that you have, the ratio between the various cache block size miss ratio curves will change. And so you can make this decision now completely online, right? So that's just one example, cache block size. There's other ones. Like, for, you know, most systems have both a read and a write cache. And it's always a question, who should I give more to, read or write? Now you can answer that, because, you know, what do? You compute a read miss ratio curve and a write miss ratio curve, compare them, right? Replacement policies, like if you have any other tuning parameters, like a sub-block size, or write-through versus write-back, all of those now just mean every time you have a hard decision, and you think, huh, I'm going to put a knob in my storage array because some SE is going to figure out in the field how to tune it, good luck, it never happens. Every time you make one of those decisions, you put a knob in the system, don't put a knob, just compute the miss ratio curve and do it automatically, right? We have the capability as an industry now. We should be able to do this. So we think that this could add, maybe in some cases, 100% hardware efficiency gain, possibly on top of the previous two that we set up, right? So is it clear that all you need is just a bunch of miss ratio curves and you can just do the comparison? I think it's fairly clear, right? Okay. So I mentioned earlier that LRU is not a requirement. You can actually do the same sort of thing with ARC and ClockPro. Those are the two other ones that we've studied. We're studying some other ones now. Hopefully we'll publish some results for that in the next year. But as a sample, right, both of these are possible. The way we do the non-LRUs is using something called a scaled-down simulation, which our paper talks about, so I encourage you to take a look at that in case one, your implementation in your storage system is not an LRU. We can handle that. It's just a slightly different way of actually running those computations. So interestingly, by the way, I don't know if you've ever seen miss ratio curves for ARC. As far as we know, we're the first ones to demonstrate, because we can run so many different x-axis points, because we can run them really, really efficiently, that ARC has these points where it's not a monotonically decreasing. So there are times where you add cache and the performance gets worse for a little while. Okay, we had never seen that graph before. And because it's a very adaptive cache, it makes mistakes sometimes. On average, it does well, but it does make mistakes. The other thing we're seeing is, remember the thrash remediation convex hull thing I talked about? In our initial results, what we're seeing is that LRU plus that thrash remediation is often better than ARC. And that ARC plus that thrash remediation is not that much better than LRU plus thrash remediation, which is, again, like, you know, LRU, I mean, it's been like 1960 was the time that LRU was invented. Still, we haven't still managed to totally beat it. Every time we think a new flashy algorithm is going to beat it, some adjustment to LRU catches up. And I think in this case, it'll be LRU plus thrash remediation. Okay, so systems implementation, for an example of that is a cloud physics implementation which we license, needs two function calls, right? You don't have to necessarily change your cache algorithm. Before the I/O goes into the cache, just call process ref for every block or every database row that's being accessed or whatever it is that you're trying to model in terms of cache. So you give it a data structure that's been initiated about a megabyte, and then whatever the key is, we don't even care what it is. It could be logical block address or some opaque ID. We don't care. It could be hash of the block ID. We don't care. It just has to be unique for it, and then we don't treat it in any special way. So you do that for every I/O. On average, we take about 15 nanoseconds. We've seen 40 to 38 to 60 in our experiments. On average, it'll be about 15 nanoseconds every time you call that. Okay, and then whenever you need to draw the miss ratio curve or have a higher level user level program that's going to go and do the repartitioning and all that sort of stuff, you call this function, get histo. That's it. That's all you need. Right? The rest of it is all in here, and what that is in the paper. Yeah.
And you don't have to call that for every transaction.
You call it for every transaction. The system underneath does nothing for most transactions because it's sampling. But the way that it's sampling and adaptively sampling is what makes the magic work. Okay. So you should call it for everything, and let us adaptively decide which of the transactions or keys or blocks or rows that you are accessing that we're going to do a lot of work for, and which ones we're just going to sample out.
Okay. But every time it's 15
nanoseconds. Yes. You know, I mean, 15 nanoseconds is like about one memory request. So and it pipelines really well. So you should not be. Rob, you're the first one I've seen complain about 50 nanoseconds as being an issue. Come on, this is a storage stack. The storage stack usually is like 10 micros of software. I'm saying 50 nanos, come on. Yes. Okay, so for your reference, when you look at the slides later, I talk about a whole bunch of different use cases that I have not covered, that once you have a misrosure curve, they become enlightened, and you can actually do either better performance or better service level assurances. So there are some multi-tenant environments in the world that are very popular, like cloud service providers, and the features that I'm not going to go through this in detail. I only have 7 minutes. But a lot of people in the world are using some sort of global LRU. And global LRU is when you have multiple clients and they hit the same LRU. Now what happens there is like pigs at a trough, right? The bigger one keeps getting bigger. So if you have a global LRU and you've got a workload that's really intense, what's it going to do? It's going to push everybody else's workload out. But it's a priori and naive, and using a naive system, it's very hard to even know who the thresher is and what to do about it, how much to mitigate the thresher. It's just very hard to know that, right? So this is like getting an x-ray of your trough or the pigs at the trough and trying to figure out, well, how are you going to manage this, right? What are you going to do about it? So anytime you have multi-tenancy, right, this just extenuates a need for being able to have a data-driven way of online managing your the ability of your clients to get access to the performance resources that you've invested in. Okay? So I won't read through it, but I think by now, hopefully, that's all in context. So what I want to do is set step-by-step recap. So to be able to use this technology, the first step is to calculate the misrosure curve. So pictorially, I'm drawing that out with some steps that once you see the previous year's tutorial, you'll know what they are. But again, the point is that they're trivial, really, once you see them. Okay? It took us years to build it, but now once you look back, you're like, wow, why didn't I think of that in the last 20 years? Right? So first step, misrosure curve. So trivial integration with your current cache code base. A couple of functions, one for every I/O, very fast. Okay? And whenever you need to put that in a UI or run a higher level process, you just suck the MRC out, compare everybody, make a decision, and then come back, you know, minutes or hours later to finish it off. Second thing you can do is display the cache utility curve. For DevOps people, for people trying to do optimizations in your system, for SEs, for customers to be able to self-manage. The third thing is auto-tune cache parameters, right? Let's get over those days where we ship 50 different parameters and nobody ever touches them. So as engineers, we feel real good. It's like, oh, look, we got so many knobs. And in our labs, we can show 50, 100% performance improvements. Well, enough is enough. Let's just not do those knobs or do them, but have them automatically set, because now we can actually accurately predict on a per workload or per LAN or per whatever basis what the performance difference will be for every one of our knobs in that cache. Okay? Step number four, thrash remediation. Talked about this in a lot of detail. Once you have the MRC, this starts to become easy, and you can tame the worst workloads. In fact, this is the worst the workload, the more awesome this looks, because it's designed to address. So a very cache-friendly workload will get no benefit from this. An unfriendly workload could get 100% performance improvement from this, right? Next is latency guarantees. So now we've got this really nice curve, okay? But that really nice curve hides in it the ability to say, I can control how much cache I give this workload. If I can control that, I can predict the performance improvement they're going to get, and I can predict the latency. Now, the same thing can be done for IOPS. I care less about IOPS as a human being than I care about latency, but that's just me. But if you wanted to do IOPS, that's fine. I mean, it's just a slightly different curve. You know how I showed you how to compute using the miss and the hit ratio and the hit and miss latency? The same thing can be done for IOPS, and you can get the curve for IOPS, and then it'll just be the opposite curve. It'll be higher is better. Okay, so now for the first time in the industry, we can use the cache as a control mechanism, as an SLO guarantee sort of mechanism. I think that's a game-changing opportunity. Next is accurate tiering decisions, or close cousin to the last couple things we talked about. But instead of just having two regions, the cache region and the uncached region, and you change the boundary, now we have multiple. Maybe the last one is a cloud with maybe a 20, 30 millisecond latency, 50 millisecond latency, right? Even in those scenarios, the iteration iterative algorithm that can sit on top of this and change multiple barriers can find sub-millisecond latency even when your worst case latency is 50 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds, because we can accurately size all the intermediate caches, right, and do that iteratively. Okay? Next step, multi-tenant partitioning. So we saw a case where we had average of 40%, in some cases up to 150% performance improvement by just repartitioning the caches once an hour. Not even minutes or anything like that. Once an hour. All we needed was the mismatch occurs for each client, and we would adaptively do it. And in this example, I'm just showing two, but in the testing we did, we had anywhere from 8 to 20 different workflows running at the same time to get that. Now, the cloud tier we already talked about, kind of as a special, this is a special case of step number 6. And then the final piece that I'm going to leave you with, and we have 5 minutes for questions. So the final piece here, this is an open area. I'm working with universities on this right now. Someone had alluded to this as a question earlier, which is, hey, these mismatched curves, how stable are they? Right? Are they shifting and kind of undulating and moving throughout the course of a day or a week? Well, they are. They're kind of reasonably stationary when you're at a day scale. Now, the nice thing is the algorithms, as the mismatch curves change, they adapt and they give you the new mismatch curve. But we don't yet have a theory of the behavior of these workloads and the behavior of the MRCs. We don't have a theory about that yet. So we're very actively working to try to figure that out. And I think that the interesting thing is, here's the amazing thing, right? Imagine if instead of just knowing about how much to size a cache or how much to not size a cache, you know, on a day or hourly basis, you could come in and say, I'm going to turn the cache off because it's better for me to turn it off now than to turn it on later. Okay, and so there's some heat map type of stuff that we're working on where we're trying to figure out, like, are there some kind of theoretical results, just like the previous work that we did, right? Started off with ad hoc stuff and ended up with a theory. We're trying to develop a theory for being able to do time series analysis of mismatch ratio curve and then to put them in a control loop. Probably take us another couple years to have good results there. We have some initial results. So idea is to take the basic computation of the mismatch ratio curve and then apply various types of data analytics on it so that we can get even time varying prediction, not just kind of a stationarity assumption. Okay, so that's all I have. So I hope that, you know, I've managed to interest some of you in following up on this work and taking a look a little bit deeper. I think we're at a stage now, you know, when the technology is first invented, the first kind of work in this was about 3 years ago, where there's a barrier to entry because, you know, even the inventors haven't figured out how to explain the technology yet, right? Haven't really built the use case, haven't figured out how to explain it. I think we're at the marginal return. So waiting any longer than today, as vendors or as systems or cache designers, I think it's not going to give you much benefit because I think most of the work has been figured out here. Most of the challenges have been addressed. I'm not saying there's not challenges, and since some of these things are still will take you some time to implement. But we're at that, you know, marginal return in terms of your return for waiting. So I don't think there's any point in waiting anymore. I think we should be investing in this as an industry. Questions? Comments? Yes?
So most of the talk that you talked here was always about block address. So how does it cater to the whole system memory and more byte address? Shifts over? I mean, like, it's exactly the same for those type of technologies?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. So the way to think about it is that any place you might want to insert a cache, once you put data in the cache, you got to get it out. So you key every element in the cache with some unique key. Okay. The mismatch ratio curve computation only uses that key, nothing else. It doesn't care about your cache implementation. It cares reasonably about it, but it's not tied to it. And it doesn't really care about the cache size that you currently have or you might have, right? It just says, look, just give me the list of keys that might be logical block addresses. It might be Redis, you know, memory, like random keys or something like that. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. So that's for the mismatch ratio computation. So as soon as you do the mismatch ratio computation, everything else is built on top of it, so it should be safe. Yeah, good question, yes.
One question, for cache, you have certain underlying assumptions about LRU,
yes,
and ARC, etc. For tiering, are you making other assumptions about how the tiering is done, or is this dependent on the tiering algorithms?
underlying data?
So when we looked at tiering, what the assumption being made was that the work, so this particular thing is, this example is LRU. The same example could have been done with ARC. So I think the more important question is, what if part of your system is LRU and part of it is ARC and part of it is some other sort of mechanism that's not even like a cache? It could be, for instance, you know, some other like machine learning system running underneath that's saying, hey, these blocks are accessed every like 4 days and a half, so I'm going to pull it in or something like that, right? So that is open. I don't know the answer to that. But as long as it's a traditional cache algorithm, we can deal with it in this way. But I do know, for instance, some EMC arrays, they don't use a cache algorithm for their tiering. On the other hand, what this tells you is, if you were to cache, what would the benefit be? Now, maybe you can do better than that. But I actually kind of doubt that most systems, once you pull in this type of technique, can do much better than just pure cache. Because, I mean, again, we have 57 years of history of people trying to beat LRU and not being able to. Good question. So I would really like it if I got a chance to say hi to all of you. There might be a talk in here, I'm not sure. We can step outside, but it would be nice. I spend an hour with you. Would love to kind of know who you are and exchange LinkedIn maybe and keep in touch. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it. Okay.
Thanks for listening. If you have questions about the material presented in this podcast, be sure and join our developers mailing list by sending an email to developers-subscribe@snea.org. Here you can ask questions and discuss this topic further with your peers in the developer community. For additional information about the Storage Developer Conference, visit storagedeveloper.org.